Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to episode 1488. And remember, since we did bonus episodes last weekend, we will have our 10th episode show on a different day that will appear on Monday rather than later in the week as it usually does. So it gets a little out of order. Don't be confused. Not that each day, whatever day it lands on, matters, but just in case. Okay, we've got part two of the rant from Harry Dent. As we did just a little part of part one yesterday, I think you sensed that Harry really had some very strong opinions. And, you know, he is just a super interesting economist. Certainly, like every economist, he's made some predictions that didn't come true. But, you know, he's also made some that really did come true and some that came true just a little bit late. So he's an interesting guy, no doubt about it. So don't let some predictions that didn't come true turn you off. Because I noticed that some people get that way about this person, this economist, that economist. You can still learn a lot just by understanding the underpinning theories that create the thought. See, sometimes we are out in the world and we don't even consider a premise, a foundational belief system. And then someone comes along, an economist, a thought leader in whatever topic, and gives us that idea, and maybe they draw the wrong conclusion, or they don't consider another extraneous factor, and their prediction doesn't come true. But aren't you better off for having another tool in your toolbox, another way to think about a possibility? Of course you're better off. So this is why I listen to and read a lot of opposing beliefs, okay? I listen to all sorts of stuff. In fact, I have guests on the show frequently that I think they're out of their mind, okay? Next week, you're going to hear from a Marxist professor who calls himself a Marxist. And it's going to be interesting. Trust me, it's going to be interesting. And I got to tell you, probably the only interview I have ever actually prepped for was my first interview years ago with Bill Ayers. Now, you're not going to find me agreeing with Bill Ayers on much of anything. But I got to tell you, that was one of the most interesting shows I have ever done. There's a lot you can learn from a lot of people just by their thinking process, even if their prediction did or didn't come true. And, you know, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But the idea is to gain more tools, to gain more reasoning power. And by hearing the way Harry Dent, for example, lays out his reasoning, sometimes it enhances our thinking too. So that's good. Let's see if we can get one or two listener questions before we get to Harry. I promised Josh, our producer, this intro would be really short because we have a lot to cover on the Harry Dent side today. And I might be about to break my promise, but here goes. Okay, so James Altucher. Yes, that is the famous author and thought leader, James Altucher, who's been on this show a few times before, and he actually submitted a listener question. The question from James Altucher is, do you think tax liens might be an interesting business right now? What do you think about buying them? Will people be relinquishing their properties without much of a fight? And I think what he's referring to is back during the Great Recession, how people just walked away from their properties. And many people could easily afford to keep those properties, but they did what we talked about many times, known as strategic default. Millions and millions of people did this. And look, That's the bargain. That's the deal. You don't want to pay your property taxes. You don't want to pay your mortgage. Then you agree to relinquish the collateral. That's the deal you make with the lender, with the tax collector, et cetera. So I don't know that this is going to change to a great degree, James. And I don't know yet if it will. Here's why. It depends where. So in the densely populated cities, like where you live in New York, I think there is going to be a terrible compounding economic crisis. New York City, downtown Chicago, downtown Miami, downtown Boston, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, San Diego, I don't know. I'm sure I've missed some here, right? Any high density area where it's also in a cyclical market. Those markets that when you're looking at a chart, they look like a roller coaster. Glorious highs, really ugly lows. Those are the markets that get all the news, get all the media attention, but they're some of the worst places to invest because it's always really just gambling and speculation. It's not true investing. I do think in those markets, there will be a lot of foreclosures. And you could pick up tax liens and turn them into tax deeds and maybe make some money. We've done some shows on this in the past. Be careful. As many of you know, I really got ripped off pretty badly by a tax lien promoter. And I can't say too much about it right now because the outcome is yet to be determined. And also in the business of flipping properties and selling homes to investors and stuff like this. But, you know, one of their product lines is tax liens and tax deeds. And then we had my friend, Julia Spencer, on the show just recently. Again, she was back talking about tax liens and tax deeds. So yes, like anything, there is definitely opportunity there. The problem is that I don't think the vast majority of those opportunities will present themselves in the ideal areas in which to invest. I think they will be presenting themselves in declining areas that are now declining for a much different reason than during the Great Recession, during any of the recessions before that, or even the Great Depression. This time, it's the combination of that 1-2 punch of a pandemic, which is we haven't had this in 102 years. Yes, we had some little ones, but they didn't really affect us like this one, obviously. But the Spanish flu was the big one, and that's just too far back. We can't evaluate something from 102 years ago very well. And then we had the economy and the business cycle that was probably due to correct anyway. So we kind of got this 1-2 punch this time. So we'll see what happens. So if you buy tax liens and tax deeds, if you do it in good linear markets that are low density suburban areas, like the ones you'll find at jasonhartman.com/properties, then I think you're fine. But then you've got to evaluate the deal individually and make sure it's a good deal. And you got to know what you're doing because there are a lot of complexities in the tax lien and tax deed, tax sale business. By the way, due to popular demand, I think we are going to run our webinar again on tax sales and tax sale overages. So look for an announcement about that. We'll probably bring that back. And by the way, I'd love to get some feedback of those of you who signed up and took the course and really decided to check that opportunity out. We are going to be talking a little bit about not just real estate investing in the future here as we go through this crisis economy we're in, this pandemic economy, about some opportunities to actually generate income, usually related to income property, but not our typical plan. So like the tax sale opportunity that I just mentioned. So you'll see a little bit more of that from time to time, like you saw during the Great Recession. Listeners asked for that, so we're doing that. Okay, so a related question comes from Britt Burns. And Britt says, "Dear Jason, I saw your interview on Ken McElroy's show." Ken McElroy, of course, is the Rich Dad, Poor Dad advisor, Rich Dad advisor with Robert Kiyosaki. He's been on our show a few times. I've been on his show. And so Britt says, "Dear Jason, I saw your interview on Ken McElroy's show. I found out about you a few months ago through George Gammon. My question is, you mentioned on Ken's show that you were seeing a, quote, supply-demand shock, unquote, in the airlines right now due to there being less planes being used. So fewer routes being canceled." I'm adding that. Then you mentioned this will hit the housing market. But a few moments later, you mentioned there will be massive foreclosures. I'm trying to figure out if you were implying that home prices will remain high because of the artificial shortage, or if they would drop due to massive foreclosures. To give you a point of reference, I'm thinking about homes in the suburbs of Los Angeles. Thank you, Britt. Britt, that's a great question. So as I wrote you back in that email, you know, basically the same thing applies as to what I just said about James Altucher's question. The question is where? Is it a densely populated cyclical market? Cyclical markets that were going to correct anyway, that were already softening, that were already in trouble. All of those high-flying markets, the West Coast of the United States, so from San Diego on up to Seattle and really up to Vancouver, Canada even, which is an absolute disaster. The poster child for overinflated cyclical market would be Vancouver, Canada. Beautiful city, but ridiculous real estate market. And then South Florida and the expensive Northeastern markets. All of these markets are going to see massive foreclosures because they don't make any sense, and add to that the social distancing problem and the high density living that nobody wants anymore. So I do think there will be significant foreclosures there. The supply demand shock issue comes in, and I use the airlines to illustrate that. And I talked before on a previous episode here about how I researched prices at the beginning of the quarantines and lockdowns. We saw airline prices for a ticket from Miami to LA, which is sort of a typical ticket that anybody might buy. I looked that up, and then I looked at the price history of it. And what you saw is as we went into the lockdowns, but there were still lots of routes and flights weren't canceled in any great degree, we saw prices plummet because there was no demand, there was massive demand destruction, yet there was a lot of supply. So the prices dropped dramatically. And that ticket from Miami to LA got to about $50. If you could, $50, Miami to LA. And it was normally hovering around $330, then went down to $50. Then it went way back up. And I can't remember the price. I think it was like $400 and something, because the airlines canceled a bunch of routes and parked their jets on runways and in jet parking lots in, I don't know, New Mexico or something like that. So that is an example of supply-demand shock, a rare economic malady that we saw in the 1970s dramatically, and the misery index was really talked about a lot back then. It was the Jimmy Carter era. It was bad, bad, bad. It's miserable. Supply-demand shock, not a good thing. How does that affect the housing market? Well, first, when the lockdown started, we had demand destruction. But then we had supply destruction like immediately after that. Because think about it, a lot of the ingredients of a house come from China. Guess where those doorknobs are made and those hinges are made and those cabinet doors, a lot of them, and the electrical outlet sockets and the dome lights in the ceiling and those recess lights in the ceiling. A lot of this stuff's made in China. And China just shut down for a few months. And so you had supply shock. And when you have supply-demand shock, it's a kind of a miserable environment. And we've even noticed this ordering things on Amazon. Things that used to be here the next day or the day after are 3 weeks out. With all this home office stuff, try buying a webcam now. Just go look it up online. I talked to Logitech because we've got our upcoming Meet the Masters virtual conference, and I wanted to get a new webcam. And Logitech says that the webcam I wanted is a 16-week wait. 16 weeks. Now, in the old days, I wouldn't have thought that was a big deal. Or in a communist country, I wouldn't have thought that's a big deal. It'd just be normal. You'd call the commissar of webcams and, you got to wait 10 years for your webcam, right? That's how it was. But you see, there has been a huge disruption in the supply chain. So it's really weird. We've all become spoiled. We're used to getting stuff the next day. It's just this webcam's just a typical consumer product. No big deal. You should get it the next day. They have tons of inventory of this stuff usually, and it's just immediately delivered. Not anymore. Just go look it up. Go try and buy a Logitech Logitech webcam online. Good luck. The ones you'll see that used to be $59 are being sold by other sellers for $238. So that's a great illustration right there of supply-demand shock. At first, no demand, then no supply. There you go. All right. Hope that helps. I hope that answers your question, Britt and James Altucher. Appreciate the questions. We will have a registration page for Harry Dent soon. We've got a couple webinars running for you as well, and you can look for the links in the show notes for those. And we are here for you. JasonHartman.com, 1-800-HARTMAN. Here's part two of Harry Dent on a rant. Harry, you mentioned gold earlier, and I don't know if I've ever talked to you much about, I'm just kind of curious your take. I have a feeling I know what it is, but I won't say it. I'll let you say it. What do you think about, you know, cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin? What does Harry Dent think about that? I don't know if we've ever talked about it.
Well, slightly different things. They're supposed to be the same, and crypto could eventually be the digital gold as a standard for money, but they're nowhere near that. Number one, I'm going to start with Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. They're in what I call the hype phase, the same place the internet retailers like Amazon and the new .com, all those surged at the very end of the last tech bubble, mm-hmm. between late 98 and early 2000, gave it most of its oomph. Companies valued AOL, which actually had real sales and earnings. Right. Most of them had none.
Right.
Just valued at 400 times earnings. That was an impossibility. Yeah. And
Zoom is about there. Yeah.
Billion-dollar companies with no sales or very little sales and losses. So that's the hype phase. Hyped up, and then they busted 95%. Tech stocks went down 78% in that big crash. They went down 95%. Mm-hmm. Crypto's the same thing. They've had a great bubble, bigger than the internet bubble, not in capitalization, but in size of the bubble, but up there. And I think they're going to crash. You don't know that the crypto's gone through this hype phase, Bitcoin and all these companies, until you see a lot of companies fail, like the internets did in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. Yep. That hasn't happened yet. So I keep lecturing to crypto conference. They say, oh, Harry, if you're right about this big crash, just going to usher in the digital currency age. People are going to not trust currency. I'd say, after that, mm-hmm. yeah. after that, you guys are the biggest bubble and you're going to burst the most. Now, what did we just see in this crash? What went down more than stocks? Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Stocks went down 40% at worst. Bitcoin went down like 50-some percent. Gold did what it did in 2008, went up. Now, I'm talking the early stage of this crash, the first several days, went up a little bit. Oh, money printing, you know. And then when the crash hits, it goes down 12%. Gold ended up down. It was not the hedge to the stocks. What went up? Treasury bonds, highest quality long-term bonds, like the falling interest rates, the deflationary side, and don't have default risk like a lot of corporate bonds do. So crypto did the worst, and I've been telling the crypto people, you're going to have the biggest crash when I'm right, and then you'll be the next big thing. Because internet had the biggest crash. Mm-hmm. Amazon went from 6 to 166, back down to 6, and now to 2,400, mm-hmm. 15 years later. Yeah. Greatest boom in history. I mean, internet was the next big thing, but it had to go through its shakeout first because it was mostly baloney.
Yeah, yeah. The pets.com sock puppet and all the web
van. So gold is not the safe haven. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. It's not the worst place to be. Mm-hmm. In the first crash, it only went down half as much as other commodities. It was down 45% when other things were down 70, 80, 85 for oil. Mm-hmm. Next time it's going to be down a little more. My target's 950 to 1,000. That'll be a lot better than silver and other metals and other commodities. They'll be down 80% plus. But it's not going to be your hedge. Mm-hmm. Why? Gold correlates with one thing and better than any other probably investment in the world. It's easy to buy. Inflation.
Yeah, sure.
Gold likes inflation. The gold bugs are stuck on the last crisis from 68 to 82 when we had inflationary recessions. Mm-hmm. Inflation up, right. Economy down.
Yeah, stagflation.
That's right in my right in my summer season for the economy that was predictable to happen. Mm-hmm. So here we have a deflationary. Why are they printing all this money? They have to constantly print money to keep the economy from falling in deflation. Deflation happens when asset bubbles burst, like stocks. in real estate where people have a lot of money tied up and money disappears. Mm-hmm. And when debt fails and is restructured, which is another way money disappears. Mm-hmm. When money disappears, less money chasing the same goods and financial assets, right. Everything goes down.
Sure.
Financial assets the most, but consumer prices go down as well.
Right.
So gold is going, I think, keeps edging up while bond yields are going down. Bond yields are going down after this recovery from the crash, saying, oh, I see weakness from this virus thing, and it is going to be very U-shaped. Stocks are now finally getting some reality. Oh, yeah, what were we thinking? We're mm-hmm. going to go right back to normal. I mean, right. Stocks on the NASDAQ got near its highs, you know, mm-hmm. what, 8 or 9% from its highs? That's absurd with what's just happened. So stocks are going down. Gold's still edging up, thinking, yeah, but they're going to print. But they get gold's got to remember, 2013, 12 to 13 transition, print. Japan was the first to go to what I call unlimited, just, you know, printing off the charts. And inflation kept going down. The gold bugs finally had to admit, oh, my gosh, money printing doesn't necessarily cause inflation. Oh, my God, Milton Friedman was wrong when he says it's entirely a monetary right. phenomenon, yeah. which I've been saying for years. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what's going to happen here. I think gold is going to follow bonds. If I want to look short term at the economy, do I look at stocks, gold, or bonds? I look at bonds. Bonds okay. are the most sensitive to short term risk. The bond market is saying, I see things going down. And in fact, I just got a chart from a friend in Australia. The 30-year treasury bonds, the speculators, not the commercial, not the smart money, the speculators, the broad investors are the most bearish on 30-year treasury bonds, which says they think inflation and interest rates are going up. That tells me it's going the other way.
Harry, I want to ask you.
If it goes the other way, gold is going to do poorly.
If money printing does not cause inflation, and Friedman's statement about it's always a monetary phenomenon, we all know that very well, then what does cause inflation?
Okay, first of all, the primary cause of everything I look at is people, mm-hmm. not government policy, right. short-term and reactive.
Right. Birth rate,
you know what caused the greatest inflation in history? Yeah, right, yeah. Baby boomers right. entering the workforce. You know how much it costs to raise a kid? Mm-hmm. And how much
$250,000.
Yeah, $250,000. Yeah. Governments have to fund education. That's part of their budget, as well as other things. And the last people to invest in these people are businesses who hire them when they don't know their ass from a hole in the wall, okay? Mm-hmm. And they're 18 or 20 or 22. They need an office, they need equipment, and they need training. I have an indicator called workforce growth on a 2.5-year lag that is the best correlation with short-term and long-term inflation, people entering the workforce at great expense. 2.5-year lag because it takes about 2.5 years before they start to produce more right. than they're costing to those last businesses that invest in them. So that's the prime cause. But for short-term inflation or money creation, there's two ways to create money. And this is important. Mm-hmm. I had two great economists, and they disagreed on this. My two favorite ones, David Stockman and Dr. Lacey Hunt. They're both brilliant, but they disagreed on one thing. Lacey Hunt was saying, hey, the only way to create money, Milton Friedman style, is banks multiply bank deposits. Right. We mm-hmm. deposit money, businesses, banks can lend 10-1 against that, only yep. pledge 10%
fractional
of our deposits,
lending.
By the way,
mm-hmm.
not their deposits. And that multiplies money. So in a normal economy, that's how it happens. Economy's good. Businesses and consumers want to borrow money to buy things, houses or business capacity. Then money multiplies with the multiply yeah. factor. And then if those loans keep being paid back, it continues to happen. That sort of expansion can cause consumer price inflation. Now, what has happened since 2008 and 2009, we had failed demand. We had a excess capacity, a downward economy. Nobody wanted to borrow. Putting interest rates at zero did almost nothing. So what they did was they printed money and put that money into buying financial assets. Now, they tend to buy treasury bonds and asset-backed mortgages, which are treasury-related, but that doesn't matter. New money printed out of thin air is coming not into the banking system or to consumers or businesses, as it is recently, into financial assets, more money chasing what? The same assets, which includes stocks and everything and gold and even real estate and real estate investment trusts and all types of bonds. So what we've had, the gold bugs were saying, all this money printing is going to create inflation. No, it created financial assets. asset inflation.
Right. So asset inflation versus consumer price inflation.
Asset versus consumer inflation. Yeah. That's the bubble.
Right.
That's the bubble. And it's huge. You can compare this to the 1929 bubble, which was primarily stocks. People didn't speculate in real estate because you couldn't borrow. So this is a whole nother thing. What's going to kill the Fed? I had Ray Dalio, the most successful hedge fund manager in all of history, stand up and say something stupid, you know?
He's been saying a lot of things lately I don't agree with, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, he's saying, I'm not worried about that. He's saying we're at the top. He said he's got a 6 to 7 year debt cycle and a long term 75 to 100. Well, I've got one too. It's called 90 years. I'm a much more accurate about this. 90 years, right down to it. He said, but I'm not as worried about this crash coming off this bigger cycle because the debt ratios are not as bad. I said, Ray, this is not the problem. The biggest financial asset bubble, how much money just got trashed by one stock crash globally? About $20 trillion. That's 100% of U.S. GDP. Right. That's 25% of global GDP. Yeah. Disappeared in 5 weeks.
Evaporated, yeah.
So these asset bubbles can deflate, which means money disappears much faster. If you, for debts to deflate and deleverage, you got to go through Chapter 7 or Chapter 11, and that takes some time and blah, 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 blah.
And we're going to see a lot of that.
This is way worse than the debt bubble, which was the primary cause of the 29 crash. This is a financial asset bubble that is absolute bonkers. And people are treating me, every time I interview some mainstream economist or person, they're like, Harry, you're crazy. You just predict extreme stuff. I said, you think I created this extreme period? This is the greatest bubble in history, and bubbles burst faster than they build, greater than anything else in history. I'm not creating this. I'm just reporting on it. They're acting like I'm the crazy guy. I'm the one of the few sane people on earth right now. Warren Buffett doesn't see a problem with this crap. What does that tell you? Warren Buffett says everything's okay, except he's not buying stocks now.
I know. He's sitting in cash. Hugely. Very interesting. You know, Harry, we got to wrap it up soon, but you've written a lot in your books about real estate and migration trends and things like that. And I remember a long time ago in one of your books, I read about Ashland, Oregon, and you talked a lot about that and how that was going to be a hot spot. And I actually traveled there just because I was like, I got to see what Harry's talking about. You know, that's how much influence you have. And I think there's going to be a major migration trend out of these high density living environments. And I'm calling it the rise of suburbia. I think suburbia is coming back in a big way.
Well, you know, I call it exurbia. It's like beyond exurbia. I mean, Bend, Oregon and Ashland.
Ashland is what you talked about.
I mean, they're far away from a major metro center, but you can still get there and fly easily, you know, quickly. In this online world, which we've just been kicked into deeper, I mean, look at me. I'm in Puerto Rico. Now, I'm in a city of 2.5 million, so I'm not in the sticks. My island property is in the sticks, okay, 30-minute flight from here. But I can do business from here.
Right. You know, everybody can. That's the thing.
So why would you want to live in a place like Ashland, Oregon? I've got a good friend in Miami who is a real estate kind of developer and speculator. He moved there to take over his mother's house, and he and his wife stayed. Much better lifestyle, much affordable. You know, they stayed. They didn't go back to Miami after
stayed
going
where?
There.
So stayed where? In Puerto Rico?
Ashland.
Oh, in Ashland. And I was just using Ashland as an example. The Ashland's not the thing. It's just an example because you wrote about it years ago, you know, like 20 years ago. But this idea that people do not need to be in these big cities anymore. Right. They've always had this attraction. And now both employees and employers have realized they can make the work at home thing work. The remote work thing does work. I mean, listen, we've done it for 8 years. We gave up our last office in Southern California 8 years ago, and it has advantages and disadvantages, but most of our people, they love working at home. And now you can get a better workforce because it doesn't matter where they're located. It's geographically independent. So you really have a bigger pool of candidates to pick from.
There's a bigger range. For me, I'm in San Juan. My vacation place is a 30-minute flight, 60 miles away, okay? I'd go there on vacation. I couldn't live there. I'd be bored to death. That is more remote than Ashland, Oregon, as far as a small town and nothing to do. Yeah. So I have the city life. But like you say, even if I wanted to be in New York City, why would I need to go to work every day into an office and dress up and get on mass transit and waste all the time? Why not I do that a couple times a week and then work the rest of the time from home? So I want to be in a big city.
The hybrid model.
Because I want all the restaurants and activity. I don't need to be in a big city to work.
Right. But if some of that evaporates, the Broadway shows evaporate, the restaurants evaporate, and the cost of living and the taxes are still...
Why be in New York City?
Yeah, there's just really not a compelling reason to be there. So I think suburbia is coming back. So the question is, if you're a real estate investor, which will be the stronger trend? The smaller economy that we're coming into and the economic hardship we're coming into, or and we've already began that, or the migration of people with a lot of money to spend out of these expensive, densely populated areas into suburban properties. And, you know, that's what our people have been investing in. I think it's going to be a pretty good strategy. And America's going to be on the move. The world's going to be on the move. But the rest of the world doesn't have...
I mean, the bubble alone dictates. The greater the bubble, the greater the burst. Where's the most bubbly cities? Right. Manhattan, San Francisco. San Diego, Vancouver, Miami, Toronto,
LA,
Sydney and Melbourne in Australia, the densest cities. So they go down the most. And yet, particularly wealthier people are going to tend, at least some of them are going to migrate out. And that's just going to feed that downturn more. Another sector that's going to get killed, always does, commercial real estate.
Oh, yeah.
People are emotional about their real estate and don't sell their house. Or businesses will abandon a lease or sell an office building overnight if it makes economic sense. So commercial always gets hit harder. So high-end real estate, commercial gets hit the hardest. McMansions get hit harder than everyday suburban home. The everyday suburban affordable home is both attractive now to the new millennials coming up, the new wave, who still haven't bought a lot of their houses yet because they haven't been able to afford to, and retiring baby boomers who don't have the kids and want to downsize. They just need a 2-3 bedroom house. And they even less need to be in the city.
Right.
They can be in a nice, quiet suburb. So those are the best houses to buy in the downturn, the best houses to keep. And I've been working with a guy in Arizona that's training people to take over McMansions when they collapse and turn them into assisted living things, because large houses will be useful for small assisted living facilities. In suburbs where people would rather
That's probably my friend Gene. I know him.
Yeah, Gene.
Yeah, yeah. So the thing about that is I kind of wonder, because, you know, the assisted living homes have been such hot spots for, you know, high death rates and infection rates. And I agree that the size of that, the smaller home you're in, the better chances you have of survival. But I even think, I think there's going to be a trend really toward multi-generational living, which is, you know, very common. Around the world.
Well, people may keep a McMansion so they can have their parents there.
But it doesn't even have to be a McMansion. It can just be, you know, a suburban 4-bedroom house, or, you know, a house with a casita in the back. Not even a McMansion. Just a, you know, a nice
one of the things
house.
I see, if you think the way I think, because the high end is so much more overvalued, that why would you buy an everyday suburban home when you can buy a McMansion with 2 or 3 extra bedrooms and a bigger lot
for not much more.
A lot more. And you could house your parents there instead of having them in an assisted living facility, which costs, by the way, $9,000 to $10,000 from our experience a month.
It's very expensive. And I think the insurance is going to be tough to get on those, because the infection rate problem and just in general, the insurance industry having so many problems. I mean, there's a massive wave of claims coming at the insurance industry, and we're going to see a lot of problems with insurance real soon, too. So I think multi-generational living, roommates splitting up, getting their own houses, they need that extra.
Two families may live in one big mansion at 20% more of the price, but you split that, you're both saving money. So,
But that's the opposite of the two single people as roommates in a 2-bedroom place.
Yeah.
Because now they need that second bedroom for a home office. Okay. And
But all of these are good changes. If we use our real estate better, if we save money on certain things or commuting. I mean, look, and pollution levels have just disappeared.
Totally declined.
And traffic congestion. Yeah. These are the two biggest problems
in
cities.
It's kind of nice in a lot of ways. Yeah.
This is a big win-win. See, this is why I love change. People hate change. I love change. Yeah. Change makes things better. It can happen too rapidly sometimes, but this is going to be a good thing. I'm just warning people, as you know, Jason, this is going to be a major shock, more than anybody's ever going to see in their past lifetime, because you weren't around in the early 30s, or going to see in the future. Financial assets, stocks are going to end up falling 80% or more. Real estate in the U.S., 40 to 50% more than last time.
High-end real estate, commercial
real
estate.
Gold is even going to fall. The one true money. Yes, that's going to fall, and people are going to be in shock. This does not have to happen. These are predictable things. We've got this first crash, 40%, exactly what I predicted it would be. We're in this 4, 5, 6 month rebound, which is typical, where it's choppy and won't go a lot higher, but stocks will hold up in hope, and then we'll fail again, and we'll go into real deleveraging.
Well, and they're being propped up by the Fed. Downturn. You know, the stock market's
just if people don't prepare for the next, it's all right if you got whacked 40% because it's already, you've already gotten half of it back, you know, to make it a little better. What's going to be the crime is if you don't see this and get ahead of the next one, because the next one's going to be much deeper and longer, and it's going to be a once in a lifetime threat to your financial assets and business, but it's also going to be a once in a lifetime sale on financial assets and business assets on the bottom. If you do get out like Joseph Kennedy, or you do hunker down like General Motors in the early 30s and pass your competitors. General Motors passed Ford forever to become number one in cars for the first time, and then became number one in global corporations. That largely was made by its handling of the 30-32 crash.
Yeah, the world's first billionaire came out of the Great Depression, J. Paul Getty. So there's a
Joseph Kennedy, he was a multimillionaire bootlegger, came out ultimately a billionaire political dynasty. Same thing, out of that crash. He got out of the top, reinvested when businesses were selling for 80 to 90% off. That's a sale.
That's what J. Paul Getty was doing. He was buying up oil companies.
The mafia made more money than anybody in the Great Depression. They were loan sharks at 20% with high cash flow from the bootlegging roaring 20s. And then the businesses that didn't pay them 20% and failed, they just took over at the bottom and owned it half of New York and Chicago coming out.
Well, you know, the saying, recessions create millionaires and depressions create billionaires. So we will see how it goes. But I agree with you. There's a lot of opportunity, a lot of good things that come out of this. Harry, give out your website.
HarryDent.com. So we have a free daily newsletter you can get on to get to know us if you don't already know us. And of course, and we've just split off from our marketing company we used to work with. So we're pushing our whole new letter with a monthly from me and from Rodney Johnson, my partner, both under the same roof for a very attractive price. So you can get on our full newsletters, but you can be on our free newsletter as long as you want to get a feeling for whether we make sense or not. And I think you're going to find in the next several months, we're going to make a lot of sense, because I'm telling you, nobody else is right now.
Yeah. Good stuff. Harry Dent, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.